Time. We experience it every day, and yet we barely understand it. We measure it with clocks, we feel its weight when deadlines approach, and we assume it flows forward, 1 second at a time. But what if I told you that time might not even exist? Or at least, not in the way we think it does. Hey everyone, welcome to Inertia, a podcast where I explore the intersection of physics and philosophy, breaking down the biggest questions about our universe. I'm Rania Sutton, and in this first episode, we're tackling one of the most mind-bending questions. Does time exist? And what are its implications? To answer that, we'll dive into Einstein's relativity, atomic clocks, the hour of time, entropy, and quantum mechanics. We'll then step into the world of philosophy, joined by an expert in the field, and discuss concepts like eternalism and presentism that challenge our entire perception of reality. And, of course, we'll wrap it all up by asking the ultimate question. If time is an illusion, what does that mean for us? Let's get into it. In 1905, Albert Einstein, a now household name, released his renowned special theory of relativity. This first theory essentially explained that the laws of physics are the same for all inertial frames. All inertial frames means that if something is true in one frame, like someone sitting in a train, moving at a constant speed, it also must be true in any other inertial frame, such as someone standing still on the platform, as long as both aren't accelerating. And that something encompasses all physical laws, such as Newton's laws, the conservation of energy, and more. An example of a non-inertial frame would be if you're in an accelerating car, or a spinning merry-go-round. In those cases, one would feel extra forces, like being pushed back in your seat, or flung outward. And in that case, unless you add quote-unquote fake forces, or inertial forces as physicists call them, the laws of physics don't quite work in the same way. To truly understand this, imagine yourself on a smooth-moving train moving at constant speed. You toss a ball straight up. For you, you'd see the ball go straight up and down, landing back in your hand. It behaves exactly like it would if you were still on the ground. This is because you, the ball, and the air in the train are all moving at the same constant speed, putting all three of you in the same inertial frame. What Einstein's theory states is that a person standing on the platform outside, while they'd see it moved in a curved arc because the train and the ball are moving forward while the ball goes up and down, they'd still be able to use the same laws of physics to explain the motion without any need to make up those fake forces. This is what led Einstein to the conclusion that motion is relative, meaning there's no absolute view of what's happening because the observers see different things. All that is absolute is the laws of physics, as long as you're still in the same inertial frame. However, if you were to throw the ball up while the train was accelerating, it would land behind you, because the train sped up while the ball was in the air, and you'd be in a non-inertial frame, feeling as if a force pulled it backwards, even though nothing actually pushed it. But what does that have to do with time? Imagine if instead of a ball, you had two mirrors, with a beam of light bouncing between them, with each bounce being called one tick. This is what is known as a light clock. Inside the train, in your inertial frame, the light would simply be seen to be bouncing straight up and down. But to the observer on the platform, the light follows a zigzag path, because the train is moving sideways, and so the constant speed is irrelevant here. Just like with the ball, the light travels a different observed path in each frame. The zigzag path, quite intuitively, takes longer to follow through than the straight up and straight down path. But there's a twist. Einstein's second postulate is that light always travels at the same speed, no matter the time frame. So, if the light takes a longer path, in the platform observer's view, and the speed of light doesn't change, the only thing that can change is time. So, to the observer on the platform, your moving light clock ticks slower, meaning you experience time slower. That leads to the other conclusion, that time is relative, also known as time dilation. Of course, the time difference in normal applications is so minuscule that even the most precise clocks we have wouldn't be able to measure it. Even, for example, a very fast high-speed train would move, say, at a speed around 190 miles per hour. In his special relativity paper, Einstein derived the time dilation formula. It's sometimes called the Lorentz time dilation formula because it uses the Lorentz factor, developed by Hendrik Lorentz and Henri Poincaré in their work, The Lorentz Transformations, in the late 19th to early 20th century. It connects the proper time, measured by the observer moving with the object, to the relative speed of the moving object, as well as the speed of light, to calculate the dilation. If we plug that train speed in, the time difference would be as small as 140 trillionths of a second per hour. That's why time dilation was not discovered until Einstein came up with it in 1905, because the effects are so small in our day-to-day lives that they're practically impossible to notice with common instruments. That leads us to an interesting branch of physics in real-world applications, atomic clocks. It was in 1967 that scientists from around the world convened at the 13th General Conference of the International Committee for Weights and Measures to answer a deceptively simple question. How long is a second? For centuries before that, time was based on movements of the sky. It wasn't until the late 1500s, with the spread of the Gregorian calendar, that a second became part of society's official timekeeping. Since the calendar had defined one day as a single rotation of the Earth about its x-axis, they simply divided that value by 24 for hours, then 60 for minutes, and 60 again for seconds to describe it as 1/86/400th of a day. But, as ever as the trend of our world became increasingly connected, with the rise of systems like railways, more precision was called for. Enter the atomic clock. Unlike pendulums, atoms oscillate with astonishing consistency. In the 1950s, researchers discovered that by exposing atoms to electromagnetic waves, they could generate a perfectly stable tick at the quantum level. At the aforementioned conference, scientists evaluated which atom could serve as this ultimate timekeeper. They needed something stable, high frequency, easy to vaporize, and simple to measure. The winner? Cesium-133. Using the most accurate data available, they matched one international system units, or SI, second to exactly 9,192,631,770 ticks of a cesium-133 atom. This technology and definition continues to underpin our timekeeping today, from GPS satellites to global communication. But what happens when the need for even smaller scales, even more accurate measurements of time arises? In fact, even with modern technology, most atomic clocks themselves would only notice differences in time on a scale like we discussed earlier, over very long timescales, such as hours or even years. However, one kind of atomic clock that can measure up to that standard are much more modern, known as optical lattice clocks. They work by trapping atoms, such as strontium or ytterbium, rather than cesium, in a grid of intersecting laser beams, a standing wave of light known as an optical lattice. The atoms are held at positions in the lattice's peaks or valleys, depending on the laser wavelength, and can be further manipulated using magnetic or electric fields. The heart of the clock lies in tuning a laser to exactly match the natural frequency at which an atom's electrons transition between two energy levels, and this frequency can be hundreds of trillions of cycles per second. While the atom doesn't jump between energy states every time the light wave oscillates, it is constantly interacting with those waves. The actual way that time is measured has nothing to do with how often the atom makes that jump. Rather, we care about the exact frequency that causes it to jump energy states. That frequency defines an incredibly regular, stable tick rate. That's because the lasers cool the atoms to temperatures so close to absolute zero that their motion is almost completely stopped, allowing the frequencies to remain stable and undisturbed. Once the laser is locked to the atom, each wave cycle of the light is counted as a tick of the clock. The atom's consistency essentially turns itself into a perfect tuning fork for time, with its response telling scientists when the laser is perfectly on pitch. For example, strontium's laser frequency of 429,228,004,229,874 cycles per second, which was calculated through high-precision spectroscopy conducted by researchers at the University of Tokyo, is divided down by electronics into something we can use, like seconds. An ytterbium optical lattice clock developed at the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics exhibited a fractional frequency instability of 1.6 times 10 to the minus 18. In contrast, the National Institute of Standards and Technology F1 cesium fountain clock, the one that serves as the United Nations primary time and frequency standard, achieves a stability of approximately 1 times 10 to the minus 15. This represents an improvement factor of roughly 625. The interesting thing is, despite optical lattice clocks being more accurate with the right frequency and precise with the same result every time, the official definition of a second hasn't changed from the original cesium. But why? Diving into this question reveals a lot about the way the world's systems are set up. According to Jerome Ludewig, an academic researcher in optical lattices and atomic clocks from the Observatoire de Paris at the University of Paris, the progress in completing certain milestones set by the International Committee let us envision a possible redefinition of the SI second as early as 2026. However, the general scientific community is wary of rushing a decision like that. Many reference the fact that timekeeping is one of humanity's oldest scientific efforts, and historically, even minor adjustments to how we measure time takes years of discussion, planning, and global coordination. They argue that rushing the process risks creating major complications, since the field affects legal systems and requires political, scientific, and engineering alignment. Take our 60-based systems of minutes and seconds, for example. That was inherited from the Babylonians around 3100 BC. To complicate matters even further, the choice of which frequency to use isn't simple. We don't just want to base our standard on a fancy new clock today if a better, more stable design is just around the corner. It's not enough for the clock to be ultra-precise. It also needs to be easy to replicate and operate globally. The current network of atomic clocks already has to correct for altitude and location. Optical clocks might even need to account for the moon's gravitational pull in real time, because even tiny disturbances result in noticeable error, since the clock is so precise that it can detect those differences. But let's move on. We've understood what Einstein's special theory says about time, but what about his arguably more profound and revolutionary set of principles, his general theory of relativity? One key difference between the two is that while special relativity argued that space and time are inextricably connected, it didn't acknowledge the existence of gravity. The previous law of gravity, theorized by Isaac Newton, described the behavior of our solar system so well that almost no one at the time considered the development of a new theory to be necessary. A few physicists did, for example, with Mercury's orbital precession. The change of the planet's orbit orientation over time didn't match Newtonian predictions. By the mid-1800s, this was a largely known problem that some attempted to repair by modifying Newton's gravity. However, it wasn't until Einstein's general theory, released in 1915, that completely addressed issues such as Mercury's precession, which accounted for the excess 43 arc seconds, where an arc second is 1/3600th of a degree, alongside many others. There was another, perhaps even bigger, issue. In Newton's theory, gravity acts instantly across empty space. That means an object feels the pull of another with no medium or delay, known as action at a distance. Recall how Einstein postulated that nothing with mass can travel faster than the speed of light in a vacuum, which allowed him to understand that time was relative. That maximum speed contradicted Newton's action at a distance idea, as how could something possibly act instantaneously across large distances if nothing can travel faster than the speed of light? It was up to Einstein to challenge this theory by questioning it at these larger scales, by which he predicted that changes in gravity travel at the speed of light, not instantaneously. His new theory didn't just tweak Newton's law, it completely redefined gravity. It's also important to note that this time, the theory also incorporated acceleration and non-inertial frames, which his special theory left out. Essentially, after realizing 10 years prior that space and time were both relative, Einstein figured, as a result, that space and time could be interwoven into a single continuum known as space-time, where its curvature and distortion represents gravity. The most common visualization of this is thinking about a rubber sheet with heavier, bowling ball-like spheres representing heavier masses of objects in our universe, and smaller, marble-like balls representing smaller massed objects. Of course, the heavier the mass of the ball, the more it would distort, in a cup-like depression, the otherwise almost flat rubber sheet below it. In the analogy, other spheres could fall into the slopes of other objects, representing gravity's pull, and a push of a marble could cause it to orbit around a bigger ball, for example. As an American theoretical physicist, John Wheeler, put it, matter tells space-time how to curve, and space-time tells matter how to move. But then why does time seem to flow forward for us? Well, let's get into entropy. In physics, entropy is a measure of disorder, but that description can feel vague, I suppose. A more useful way to think about it is as a measure of how many microscopic arrangements could exist for a given state of a system. For example, when you drop an ice cube into a glass of warm water, the cube melts and the water cools until they reach the same temperature. The molecules don't stop moving, they spread their energy evenly. That's entropy increasing. It's not that the system wants to become disordered. There are simply more ways for the molecules to be evenly mixed than to stay separated as ice and liquid. This increase in entropy defines what physicists call the arrow of time. We know which direction time is moving because we can see processes like melting, mixing, or decay happening one way, but not the other. You never see a puddle freeze back into a perfect cube on its own, even though the laws of physics at a microscopic level technically don't forbid it. If you reversed every particle's motion, in theory, the cube could reform, but that would require such precise coordination that it's effectively impossible. So while the equations of motion are time-symmetric, the universe we live in is not. The reason lies in how it began. The universe started in a state of remarkably low entropy, a kind of cosmic order that set the stage for everything since. As it expands, entropy increases, not because of some deep cosmic law pointing forward, but because the initial conditions gave it a direction to move away from. Every clock ticking, every star burning, every neuron firing is tied to this gradual march towards higher entropy. Time flows, not because the equations demand it, but because we remember the low entropy past and not the high entropy future. Memory itself is built on this asymmetry. But this neat picture starts to blur a little bit when we move into quantum mechanics. In the quantum world, particles exist in superpositions, overlapping possibilities, until measured. The Schrödinger equation, which governs their evolution, is also time-symmetric. Nothing in it says that the past and future must differ. So if quantum physics is fundamentally reversible, where does the arrow of time emerge? Some physicists argue it comes from quantum decoherence. When a system interacts with its environment, its fragile superpositions collapse into one definite outcome. You can think of this as the universe constantly measuring itself, turning probabilities into the concrete events that we experience. This process increases entropy because information about the precise quantum state is lost to the environment. The arrow of time in this sense is a byproduct of information spreading out, becoming inaccessible. Others take a bit more of a radical stance, and they suggest that time might not exist at all in the quantum world, at least not in the way that we experience it. The Wheeler-DeWitt equation, a proposal from quantum gravity, describes a timeless universe where everything just is. Time only emerges when we look at part of that system from within, comparing changes between one state and another. In other words, the flow of time might just be an illusion created by our limited perspective, not a fundamental feature of reality. I suppose that when you zoom out far enough, you can kind of start to see how these principles that we've discussed connect with each other, where you have special relativity telling us that, okay, time is relative, and then we have the arrow of time telling us, okay, it's relative, but it still can't move backwards. And then once you zoom into quantum principles, some say that time doesn't exist at all. So to kind of investigate the meaning and the implications of findings like these, as well as other temporal perspectives, I'd like to welcome Joe Schmidt to the podcast. To give a little bit of an introduction, Joe is currently a PhD student at Princeton, with a bachelor's from Purdue. His research is mainly in metaphysics, philosophy of religion, philosophy of time, and metaethics. He has authored books on classical theistic proofs and existential inertia, as well as critical thinking and philosophical reasoning. He also runs a YouTube channel / podcast and blog, which I highly encourage everyone to explore, named Majesty of Reason. Hi, Joe.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation. So we should probably first get clear on some definitions here. So these two views, presentism and eternalism that you've mentioned, are views about the ontology of time. So ontology is just the study of what exists. So in short, these are views about which times exist or which things at which times exist. So presentism says roughly that only the present moment exists. There are only present objects and events. The past is no longer real in any sense. It doesn't exist at all. The future is not yet real. It, too, doesn't exist at all. Of course, it will exist, and the past did exist, but they do not exist. They are not part of reality. By contrast, eternalism says that all moments of time equally exist. So the past, present, and future are all equally real. They're all equally actual. So in this view, the universe is kind of like a block in which every event exists in a kind of four-dimensional structure. We have three spatial dimensions, but in addition to those three spatial dimensions, we also have a fourth temporal dimension along which things can be extended in time, very similar to how they are extended in space. So that is the distinction between eternalism and presentism. You can almost think of, you know, eternalism as positing kind of like seeing the universe as, yeah, like a block or some kind of like worm that's stretched out through time. So it's got like an extension temporally, just as we are extended spatially. So that's a distinction between presentism and eternalism. These aren't the only two views that you can take in the ontology of time. You could also be what's called a growing block theorist. So growing block theorists think that the past exists and the present exists, but the future doesn't exist. And So they posit, as it were, a four-dimensionally extended block, but it grows over time as more and more moments are added on to the block, as the kind of present moment dynamically changes. So that's a growing block. And then there's also this extraordinarily minority view. I actually don't know any philosophers who defend it off the top of my head, but maybe there has been a philosopher who defends this. But it has very briefly been talked about in the literature, and it is called the shrinking block theory. And this view... I laugh every time I think about it because it's just hilarious. This view says that the future exists and the present exists, but the past doesn't. So it's kind of like the mirror image of the growing block theory. So it's like the future is already there, and then it's like gradually shrinking as the present kind of goes along, and like things are lost from reality. So then eventually there will be nothing. anyway, almost no one holds that view, but those are the main views that people take in this debate about the ontology of time. So I don't know if you want to ask follow-ups there. I know you mentioned relativity theory, but that's at least setting the table in terms of the ontological views that one can take about time.
Yeah, no, for sure. Would you say that there's a kind of difference in the definition of existence when it comes to, okay, in presentism, only the current moment exists? Is that a different kind of existence than how the past and the future would exist in something like eternalism?
That's a very good question. Philosophers are divided on this. I will say, though, that the main view, as far as I'm aware, in contemporary metaphysics and philosophy of time, is that there's only one sense of existence at play here. And the presentists and eternalists simply disagree about kind of what sorts of things fall under that concept, that single concept of existence. So, you know, the future and the past and the present exist all in the same sense, according to the eternalist, and in the same sense that the presentist uses. But the presentist just disagrees with the eternalist about whether or not the future and the past exist in that sense. And so that's the typical view, that there's really only one sense of existence here. It's not like, you know, the present enjoys some kind of like concrete existence, and maybe the past and the future enjoy a kind of maybe like abstract existence or something. There are proposals that posit that. And so I'm not saying that like there are no philosophers who hold that. It's just a minority view. So most philosophers would say that there aren't different senses of existence here, but some will say. And among those who do say, yeah, they'll typically say that if they're presentists, for instance, they'll say like the present is the only moment that like concretely exists. Maybe that amounts to like having causal powers or something. And the past and the future, yeah, they actually do exist in some sense, but they only abstractly exist. They don't concretely exist. So it's a good question. There's active philosophical debate about that. And the majority view is that, no, there's only a single sense here.
Okay. So I guess I'm kind of curious about what your stance personally is then. And because I guess if someone were to adopt an eternalist point of view, that kind of also says something about their view on free will, right? If something is eternally present, perhaps, you know, if the future already exists, there's nothing that an individual doesn't have power to. I mean,
people have pushed this argument. I mean, this is a really good question. I mean, this is a very deep philosophical question. There are lots of debates about this. So I'll come to the free will question in a second. Before that, I want to briefly touch on my views here. So I started out in my philosophical journey. Well, of course, you know, I started out without views on the question because I hadn't even come across the debate. But once I came across the debate and I read up on some of the arguments in the literature, I initially was at least leaning towards presentism. I was probably like a lukewarm presentist, as it were. And I stayed that way for a few years, and I was mainly convinced by, it just seems like time kind of flows, you know, just from my own first-person perspective. It just seems like there's a kind of becoming to reality, a kind of genuine dynamism in reality where, you know, things become present and then they fade away into the past. And so there really does seem to be like objective temporal passage from my first-person perspective, and eternalism, at least of the dominant variety of eternalism, which is a kind of B-theoretic eternalism. We can define that later. But the dominant view among eternalists is that there is no objective temporal passage, and that's kind of just illusory. And that seemed really implausible to me. I thought that presentism had the best explanation of our experiences of temporal passage. Now, I noticed how I said that that was my original view. I have since come to be agnostic on this question because I was actually in writing, co-authoring my book, Existential Inertia in Classical Theistic Proofs, with my co-author, Dr. Daniel Linford. He is a staunch, shall we say, anti-presentist. And he thinks that, you know, it doesn't mesh well with what we know about general and special relativity. It just, generally speaking, doesn't mesh well in his view. This is contentious, of course, but in his view, it doesn't mesh well with our best science. And in debating this question with him over the years, I was never able to get the better of him, and it ultimately just spawned way more questions and confusions than I had answers. So I was like, well, I don't think I can justifiably be confident in presentism anymore. I think I'm just going to be agnostic. There are some serious considerations in favor of eternalism having to do with general and special relativity. General relativity seems to at least treat space-time as a four-dimensional manifold, and special relativity... it's been a while since I looked at this sort of stuff, but like the relativity of simultaneity is kind of difficult to harmonize with views that posit an objective, privileged present moment, because if what events are simultaneous is relative to reference frame, it's then going to turn out, if presentism is true, that what exists is relative to reference frame. And that seems really weird. Like, something can exist for me, but not for you. Like, that seems just so whack. Now, some philosophers take a kind of fragmentalist approach where they say, actually, you know, what exists is relative to people and relative to reference frame. And that's a tough bullet to bite. Other people will try to go anti-realist about the relevant scientific findings. So they say, we shouldn't construe these scientific theories as really telling us about the nature of reality. They're more so just like helpful instruments for predicting our observations. Anyway, there are lots of interesting and difficult debates here. My point in bringing all this up is that as a result of reflecting on all these issues, I have come to be agnostic on these various things because they are insanely difficult. Now, that's my own view. Let me now turn to your question about free will, which is a very good question. So some philosophers have indeed argued that eternalism poses difficulties for our having free will, because it seems like, yeah, like the future already exists. It's already there, as it were, and it seems like it's already settled. So how can I have a choice about how the future pans out if it's kind of already settled, if it's already there? And I grant that there's some kind of intuitive pull to that idea, but I'm ultimately not swayed by that. I think eternalism is compatible with our having free will and a kind of robust choice about how the future goes. And that's because there is a kind of directionality of explanation here. The future takes the character that it does precisely because I take the actions that I do. It's not that I take the actions that I do because the future is there and kind of settles it for me. No, it's my actions which make it so that the future facts are the way that they are, right? So although it kind of, as it were, already exists, it already exists because of my future choices over which I do have control. And if I had chosen differently, which I could have, then the future would have, as it were, always been different. So I think once we pay careful attention to explanatory considerations, I don't think it removes our freedom to our freedom in the future and our free choices about future matters. Because, you know, in short, the character of the existent future is dependent on the character of my future choices and my present choices, rather than the other way around. And if that's dependent on my free choices, I don't think it can be a threat to my having free will. So that is that's my rough take on that kind of argument. I know I've been talking a lot, but you know, this stuff is interesting.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think for me, how I kind of processed that was it's more dependent on the definition of existence, just because the decisions that lead to the result being the future haven't been made yet doesn't make them any less real, I guess, is what I kind of understood from that. And so I think there's kind of a lot to discuss when it comes to this kind of field. I would say that kind of leads into the phenomenology of time, if you're talking about things like, because I guess one could argue, or I don't know, the way I was thinking about it just now was, one argument against presentism might be that we see the flowing passage passage of time that is a human construct almost. That could be an argument, but I guess it could also, you could also argue the other side and say, well, scientific theories like special relativity and general relativity are also in some sense human constructs. So in that sense, you're kind of moving on to the phenomenology of time when you're talking about just like, does time exist without an observer at all? Or is that just, you know, a creation of human consciousness? I mean, is that actually embedded within the nature of reality itself?
Yeah, these are very, very difficult questions. I mean, they're amazing questions, and I wish I had definitive answers to them. But like, these are, I just want to say, these are like insanely good questions. So to at least say some things about them, because I don't have all the answers, unfortunately. You know, you came here for, you know, the magical genie who was able to answer all the questions, but unfortunately I'm not able to. But listen, I can at least say some things that might be able to illuminate this for people listening. So if by time we just mean like a temporal ordering, so like a system in which events stand in relations of earlier than, later than, and simultaneous with, well then it seems that like in principle, at least to me, it seems like time can exist without an observer. Most B theorists, so I should say, B theory and A theory are different. It's tough to make the distinction because different philosophers draw that distinction differently. But roughly speaking, A theorists think that the present moment is somehow objectively privileged. Like there's something objectively different about the present moment compared to other moments. And A theorists typically posit, yeah, that time like genuinely objectively flows, and it would have, you know, it would have flowed dynamically. Things would genuinely come to exist and cease to exist, even if no humans had been around. So that's the A theory. There is like objective temporal becoming, there's objective dynamism in reality, and there's something like really objectively privileged about the present moment. B theorists just deny that. They say, no, there really isn't objective temporal becoming. The experience of flow and dynamism and whatnot, that's a kind of, yeah, purely subjective phenomenon. Maybe it's some sort of construct. Really, reality is just a kind of static block where things are, yeah, extended in four spatial, in three spatial and the fourth temporal dimension. There's nothing objectively privileged about the present moment. That's what B theorists hold. Now, most B theorists and I think physicists would indeed agree that there can be a temporal ordering in the absence of observers. So like the structure of space-time governed by Einstein's field equations contains time. As far as I know, I mean, physicists can correct me, but as far as I know, the structure of space-time, according to physicists, contains time as, yeah, one coordinate in a four-dimensional manifold. And from this perspective, I mean, time is observer independent, just like space, right? And, you know, there were, let's say, you know, about 13.7 billion years before humans came along, right? So that seems to indicate, and before any sentient creatures came along, arguably, there are many billions of years. And that seems to indicate, at least according to our best science, that there can at least be time in some sense apart from observers. And that sense is like, at least this kind of B-theoretic temporal ordering. So a system in which we have events laid out in time related by earlier than, later than, and simultaneous with relations. But if by time we instead mean a kind of temporal passage that I was mentioning, right? Like the flow of moments, like a dynamic becoming of events, then the situation is more controversial. This is where the A theorists and B theorists will disagree. The B theorists will think that, yeah, like, our feeling that time is kind of passing, that's merely a subjective phenomenon. It's just a feature of like our consciousness or maybe our representations or maybe our memory combined with our anticipation of future events. Whereas A theorists will say, no, this is like, this feeling of time passing is tracking something objective about the world out there. And time would have passed even in the absence of any observers. And so time's passage is also observer independent or objective. So I think everyone should probably agree that like in terms of temporal orderings of events, that can exist without any observers, that can be objective. But A theorists and B theorists will diverge about whether or not temporal passage can exist independently of observers. So that's the rough and ready answer to your question.
Okay, yeah. I guess Actually, I think it's good that you brought up the A series and the B series, because that kind of leads on to a separate idea, which is McTaggart's paradox. And I don't know, I think I'll let you explain that in greater detail, but that does kind of, from what I know, essentially, he makes A series necessary, but then he also proves that there's an inherent flaw within it, and that kind of creates a paradox.
Yeah. Or he tries to prove that.
Yeah, he tries to prove that.
Yes, right. Okay, yeah. So here we're talking about the famous McTaggart's paradox. So this appears in his 1908 paper called The Unreality of Time. It's a pretty interesting title. That time, his basic thesis is that, yeah, time doesn't exist. It's pretty interesting. Now, as it happens, like, few philosophers accept his conclusion that time is unreal. But his challenge, his paradox, has kind of like shaped debates about the philosophy of time. So it's an important paradox. It has served as kind of a launching pad for debates in philosophy of time. I mean, as far as I know, like, yeah, most philosophers don't think that this paradox succeeds, or that like it's a successful argument against the reality of time. But the interesting question is, like, where do we diagnose its flaw, the different theories that result from solving the paradox, etc. So that's why it's still of so philosophical interest and significance, even though most philosophers think it's not a successful argument. Okay. So in order to set up the paradox, we have to distinguish between the A series and the B series. And these are closely related to the A theory and B theory that I was just mentioning. Actually, those theories blossom out of solutions to this problem, depending on what they emphasize and what they deny and what they accept. But okay, so the A series. So these are different series that order events, okay? That's what these are. In the A series, events are ordered as future, present, and past. And crucially, these positions change, right? So like an event that is future becomes present, and then it becomes past. So like an event changes in its A properties. In other words, like it was initially future, and then it becomes present, and then it becomes past. So it changes in which A properties it has. So this sort of dynamic structure, I'll leave it at that. So that's the A series. It's where events are ordered as future, present, and past, and which A properties that something has, something as an event, that changes as time flows. Okay. In the B series, by contrast, events are simply ordered as earlier than, later than, and simultaneous with one another. So, like, notice that this ordering is fixed, right? This doesn't change as time flows or as time moves along. If event A is earlier than B, it's always earlier than B, right? So, like, if the Civil War is earlier than our conversation right now, that's, like, always going to be the case. The Civil War is earlier than our conversation. That's always was the case, always will be the case. It is the case. That's never going to change. It's not like somehow the Civil War is going to become later than our conversation or something, or become present with. No. So the B series is kind of like fixed. It doesn't change. Nothing changes in its B properties. By contrast, the A series is not fixed because what's future, present, and past kind of changes over time. Okay. So that's just what these series are. That's how McTaggart characterizes them. Now, McTaggart thinks that the A series is essential to time. So he basically says, you know, you can't have time without an A series. Without the passage of events from, you know, future to present to past. So like, you know, outposts on Mars are currently future. They're going to become present, and then they will recede into the past once humans die off as a species. Without this kind of passage of events from future to present to past, we lose what seems distinctive about time, according to McTaggart. So the A series is essential to time, but he contends that the A series is incoherent, and so time is unreal. So that's his basic argument. It's that if there is time, then there's an A series, but the A series is incoherent, so there's no such thing as time. Time is unreal. That's his basic argument. Now, of course, why does he think that the A series is incoherent? That's the crucial question, and this is where his paradox is kind of comes in. So it gets pretty technical and pretty complicated pretty quickly. So it's more conducive to a written formulation than an informal verbal articulation in a podcast, but I can at least try my hardest. Yeah. So in brief, he argues that events in time, again, must have A properties like being future, being present, or being past. These A properties are incompatible with one another, right? So like, for instance, nothing can be both present and past. So these A properties exclude one another. Nothing can have two or more of them. But yet, so he points out, or so he argues, every event has all three A properties, which leads to an inconsistency. And why does he think that every event has all three A properties? Well, that's because, pick some arbitrary event, such as our conversation right now, right? This was future. So like yesterday, it was future. It's now present, and it will be past, right? Tomorrow, it'll be past. Sadly, you know, tear going down my eye, or going down my cheek. So it then seems that the event of our conversation, it seems like it has all three of pastness, presentness, and futurity, right? But those are incompatible properties. And so just positing an A series inexorably leads to inconsistency. Now, we could, of course, reply by saying that, well, hey, listen, like, in the past it was future, and in the present it's present, and in the future it's past. We could try to say that, but then we're invoking another A series, McTaggart points out, and that series itself is going to be predicating each of pastness, presentness, and futurity of the same event. And so the inconsistency, according to McTaggart, simply re-arises. And if you want to try to posit another A series to get out of the contradiction is just going to re-arise, and so you get this kind of vicious infinite regress. Each level of A properties requires another level to apparently resolve the contradiction, but this never actually gets rid of the contradiction. It only ever kind of postpones it or relocates the contradiction. And so McTaggart concludes, time itself is incoherent. Now, again, sorry for the audience. Like, this is, it's immensely abstract, and it's more conducive to a written formulation. And in fact, even philosophers disagree about how to interpret this argument, because McTaggart didn't present it in the most perspicuous way we might have wished he could have. But yeah, okay. So that's the basic paradox. How might we respond to it? Well, it seems like his contradiction only arises if we assume that all events have all of these A properties simultaneously. But listen, if we're presentists, I mean, no presentist believes that, right? No event has all of the A properties simultaneously, right? I mean, any event is, you know, only present events exist. So, you know, any event only has presentness. And I guess we can kind of, in some sense, speak of events having the property of being past. But I mean, it's difficult how we metaphysically cash that out. But the crucial point is that no event has all three of these properties simultaneously, and it seems like you only get a contradiction. These are only incompatible with one another when they're had simultaneously.
I guess where I kind of have questions about that is, if in order for it to change from in order for the properties to change from, you know, future to present to past, doesn't that require the flow of time itself? Wouldn't you need, you know, a separate flow of time to describe that flow of time, which again leads to infinite regress?
Well, this is a good question. I'm not sure if we need to posit some like entity called time, which itself kind of like changes or something like that. I think the presentist can just say, listen, I'm only talking about events, okay? And only events that presently exist, only events that have the property of being present are the ones that exist. And it's the events that are kind of the things that are flowing, right? Like, it's the events that come to be and cease to be. It's not like some additional thing in addition to them called time, which like flows. And so we need another series to govern or, you know, specify how that thing behaves. No, instead we just have the events, and the events come to be and cease to be, and none of the events ever simultaneously have the properties of pastness, futurity, and presentness. And it seems like the presentist can avoid the contradiction by saying that. They don't have to posit some like spooky entity called time, which flows. I mean, some of them do, and maybe, I mean, there's debate about this. Maybe they will still face the challenge, but we could just say, listen, there are just the events, and they can have certain properties, And it just turns out that, you know, no event ever has any of these properties. No event ever has multiple of these properties simultaneously, and that itself can just avert the contradiction. At least that's how things seem to me.
Okay, so it seems pretty easy for the presentist to kind of not even have to consider, you know, anything outside of the present because, you know, it isn't real. But, I mean, do you think it's possible to still reconcile the idea of eternalism with his paradox? Or is the paradox, you know, as you said, it's not very widely accepted among the philosophy community. So would you say that it's just kind of a linguistic issue rather than an actual, you know, an actual problem that needs to be considered? Because obviously, you know, it's quite brash to go out and say that time straight up does not exist, right?
Right. Yes. And this is actually one diagnosis that a number of philosophers have given for where MacTaggart goes wrong. Like A properties are, or at least our attributions of A properties, they are tensed. They are indexical. In other words, whether they truly apply to something depends on when you make the application, when you predicate the properties of pastness and futurity to them. So, yeah, like an event was future, is now present, and will be past, but never at the same time, and each tensed claim is only ever true relative to its own temporal context. And so if we kind of highlight that the tensed and indexical nature of predications of A properties, a number of people have argued that MacTaggart's paradox just kind of arises from linguistic confusion between this kind of tense predication, and he's trying to like force a kind of tenseless predication of these properties, ignoring their tensed and indexical nature. So that would be a kind of, yeah, linguistic confusion diagnosis, which some philosophers have opted for. And I mean, I don't specialize on MacTaggart's paradox, so I don't know like the state of the contemporary literature on whether or not this objection is like a good diagnosis of where it goes wrong, but I do know that it is a diagnosis that's out there and that is taken seriously, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So I guess while we're still on kind of the passage of time, I think you've done some work on this in terms of the idea of a self kind of enduring over this passage of time. And I guess I think it'd be interesting to kind of know what arguments there are for and the idea of a personal identity or of me or you kind of persisting as an entity throughout this passage.
Good. Yes. So this is a fun area. It's a very difficult area. I mean, all areas of philosophy are very difficult, but for me, this is a very difficult area of philosophy. Why might we think that there is such a thing as a persisting self? Well, this might have to do with like just general philosophical methodology, but like, I think it's a good starting point to give deference to our intuitive, commonsensical views, unless we have good reasons to reject them. If we don't do that, then you know it actually turns out to be very difficult to avoid radical skepticism, because then we can't sort of just trust our default, the way things default seem to us, our kind of default commonsensical intuitive judgments, in which case it's going to be extremely difficult to argue yourself out of certain skeptical scenarios like Descartes' evil demon deceiving you, or you know, dreaming hypotheses or other sorts of things. So I think it's like in general good philosophical methodology to at least give defeasible weight to the way things initially appear to one or seem to one. And when I say defeasible, that just means that, listen, we can trust them, but we should also rescind the trust when there's adequate reason to do so. So it's like we should default towards trusting them. But there can be sufficiently countervailing reasons that remove that trust, and which make us no longer believe the commonsensical judgments. Okay, so as long as we have that background in place, we accept that kind of general philosophical methodology. At least to me, I don't know, it seems like we make various commonsensical judgments that presuppose that selves exist through time. So, you know, I'm looking at an old picture of me. I was just actually at my grandma, I kid you not, was it 2 days ago? 2 days ago, I was at my grandma's 100th birthday party.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty crazy, living a century. And, you know, they had a slideshow with pictures, with when she was a child, when she was getting married, and she's like, oh, that's me. And, you know, that's when I was like this, and that was my dog. And, you know, like, there were some pictures of me in there when my grandma was holding me when I was like two or something. And everyone, they're like, yeah, that's you, Jojo. You're in the image. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. That's me. Wow. Look at me. So I don't know. It seems just pretty intuitive. Seems commonsensical. It just seems plausible that, yeah, that was me when I was a 2-year-old. And that just seems like an ordinary commonsensical judgment that seems totally innocuous to make, seems very plausible. And it seems to require that there is a self, me, there is an entity that is me and that persists through time. So if we have this defeasible trust towards commonsensical intuitive judgments, together with thinking that there are various commonsensical and intuitive judgments that imply the existence of a persisting self, that gives us reason to think that there is such a persisting self. Now, of course, there are challenges to this. So we would have to, if we want to maintain that deference to the commonsensical judgment or the intuition, we would have to engage with the relevant potential defeaters for it. But as it happens, I don't tend to think that the relevant objections in the philosophical literature that I've come across succeed, but that's perhaps a topic for, you know, another day. We probably can't get into that here. But that's one reason. Another reason, we might just think, I'm just directly aware of me, myself, I, you know, like Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, you know, like the one thing I can't be wrong about is that I exist, you know, like if I'm being deceived about there being an external world, like I'm there to be deceived, right? So I think, therefore I am, the cogito ergo sum is pretty plausible reasoning. And it seems to imply an I, which persists throughout the deliberative process when I'm thinking, oh yeah, even in order to be deceived about my external environment, for instance, I would have to be there. So, you know, I must exist right now. So like I'm going through this reasoning process. I'm directly aware of my own existence. And I'm directly aware of me kind of coming to this conclusion through time. And that all seems to just imply that I'm directly aware of myself as existing through time and persisting. So maybe we don't even need to rely on these indirect commonsensical judgments. Maybe I'm just directly aware of myself existing and persisting through time. So that's another potential. In much the same way that I can be directly aware of my pains, for instance. You know, like if I'm in excruciating pain, it'd be very, very odd to come to me and be like, oh yeah, what reason do you have to think you're in excruciating pain? Give me an argument for that, Joe. I'm like, shut up. Like, I'm just directly aware of it. So that's another possible reason to think that there is such a thing as a self enduring through change and persisting through time. I guess a final reason that I'll give is that it seems really plausible that people are morally responsible for their behavior and that they can be appropriately praised and blamed for it. You know, I think we can, you know, I think Hitler, for instance, ought not have, you know, exterminated millions of people. I think he is blameworthy for that. I think people were, I think we were doing the right thing to hold various high-ranking Nazi officials accountable after the war ended. And I think we appropriately praised that. I think we appropriately praised the, you know, the people who liberated the people in the concentration camps. And I think we appropriately blamed the Nazis for setting up the concentration camps. But it seems to me that appropriate praise and blame and moral responsibility presupposes that there is one persisting entity through time, right? Because it's like, if there is no persisting entity, if there's no persisting self, then like, it's not the same person who committed the crime who I'm now blaming or who I'm now punishing, for instance. Like, and that would be wrong. You can't punish someone else for something that someone else did. Can't punish me for what you did. That's wrong. So if there really is appropriate blame and praise and punishment, and if people really are morally responsible for their actions, it seems to me that there has to be a kind of persisting self through time, because otherwise those practices would be inappropriate, those practices would be unjustified, and it would be wrong to impose punishments or blame people for what numerically distinct entities did in the past. Those are three possible reasons why one might be attracted to the existence of a persisting self. There are other reasons as well, and of course there are objections to such a notion, but those are, I think, reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you know that I think that especially the last one kind of resonates with me personally. I think adding in perhaps a little anecdote, I mean, it's coming up to, I think, 1 a.m. here. So when I was going to sleep, you know, taking a nap before before this, I was almost thinking, I think this happens with procrastination a lot, as I think a lot of kids in our sort of generation would relate to as well. When it's like, okay, you're choosing to make, you know, a short-term decision now, almost as if you are not the one that is going to be affected by it in the future. So I think it's kind of, you know, a funny and an interesting thing to think about when it comes to, you know, personal identity and the consequences of one's own actions. But I guess my question for you would then be, what's the biggest, I mean, I don't know how widely accepted the idea of someone not, you know, an identity not persevering through the, you know, passage of time is in the philosophical community. But I mean, if there are people who believe that, you know, there are different, you know, slices of people through time, that sort of thing, what would be the biggest argument, you know, against a self enduring through time?
Ah, good question. Well, different arguments seem to convince different people. In my view, I think the biggest challenge to the existence of a persisting self. So I'm not saying that like this is the best challenge. I mean, in my view, it's the best challenge. But like my point is just that other people will think that there are other things. They might be upset that I'm not mentioning their favorite argument against the existence of persisting selves. So I'm just gonna give you what I think actually motivates a lot of philosophers not to posit persisting selves, and also what I think is perhaps the biggest challenge. And it's just that persisting selves and our ordinary commonsensical judgments are difficult to square with a naturalistic worldview, are difficult to square with a naturalistic picture of reality. What I mean by naturalistic picture of reality, well, I just mean a picture where, you know, at bottom, fundamentally, it's just either particles in motion, or maybe, you know, particles and fields and their interactions, or, you know, just maybe the wave function or something like that. And various other things are somehow emergent from that, reducible to that, fully grounded in that base of that physical base of either just like the wave function or particles and fields or just particles in motion. Turns out to be very difficult to square a persisting self with, you know, determinate identity conditions, whose existence is not a matter of convention, whose existence isn't vague. It turns out to be difficult to square that with that kind of reductionistic, physicalistic, naturalistic view of reality. For various reasons. I mean, you know, like, there's no single, like, localized, simple thing in the brain that you could identify the self with. The brain is constantly changing. Our material parts over our lives completely change, so there's no, like, single persistent material thing, it seems. There are many, well, lots of philosophers think that there are many actually material objects within this vicinity. There's like all of me minus one electron here. There's like all of me minus one electron over here. There's like all of me, and like none of these seem to be a better candidate than any of the others for being me. So there are lots of potential difficulties that you get into when you have a naturalistic picture of reality, and when you try to combine that with positing a self which satisfies the various desiderata that we would want selves to satisfy in order to vindicate a lot of these commonsensical judgments. And a lot of philosophers are deeply attached to their dear naturalism. That is, I think, one of the... And the reason why I say it's a big challenge, I think, is worth taking seriously, is because I do think naturalism, that kind of naturalistic picture of reality, is a picture of reality worth taking seriously. Mm-hmm. I have my reservations for it. I don't positively call myself a naturalist, but there are arguments for it, and it's definitely a serious contender out there for worldviews. Mm-hmm. So, given that it's very hard to square persisting selves with such a view, and given that there are at least some serious reasons to accept the view, I take it that this is the biggest challenge to the existence of persisting selves. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Okay. So would you say, like, in the general community, I mean, do you have any idea of, you know, how many people, or whether it's more commonly accepted that there is a self in your time, or is it literally just dependent on, okay, are you a naturalist, then you go that route? And
well, a lot of naturalists want to have something that's very, they want to, like, preserve a lot of our talk of selves. They want to say, like, yeah, people exist and people persist through time, and I exist and I exist through time. But ultimately, that's just like a matter of certain, you know, relevant similarities in psychological connectedness through time, you know, like similar beliefs persist over time and similar, you know, there's like a bundle of thoughts and ideas and memories and beliefs. And they try to go, what I'm saying is they try to go pretty reductionist about selves. This is what a lot of naturalists do. They try to, as it were, have their cake and eat it too. They try to fit selves within their naturalistic confines. And to do that, they typically have to reduce the existence of persisting selves to some kind of naturalistically acceptable process of, you know, psychological connectedness through time, or maybe some sort of like physical continuity of a brain or something. The jury's out of whether or not those sorts of moves can actually succeed and can actually secure a lot of our relevant commonsensical judgments. So, I mean, my sense is that most philosophers think that there, at least in some sense, perhaps a deflationary sense, there are persisting selves. That's true. But people give very radically different accounts of that. And some of them, we might think, don't actually, you know, they have it in name only, we might think. But that's perhaps a tendentious philosophical opinion on my part. So, yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Okay. No, that makes sense. Yeah. And I guess to kind of wrap things up, I guess my last kind of question to you would be, I mean, if any members of the audience want to kind of read more about this topic or learn more, aside from, of course, your YouTube channel or your blog, do you have any other kind of resources or maybe books that you'd recommend people to follow up with?
Yeah, so, I mean, one amazing book that is pretty expensive if you want it in the hardcover, but it's a really good book, and it's just a general intro to metaphysics. I'm trying to see if it's with me. It's called The Atlas of Reality by Robert Coons and Timothy Pickavance. It's an amazing intro to, like, all of metaphysics, but I think there's at least one very hefty chapter in there on philosophy of time, and so you're going to get an exploration into a lot of these issues therein. I mean, I don't recall if selves come up in there, but at least in terms of philosophy of time, you're going to get a really good overview of debates in philosophy of time. You're going to be able to follow the references that they cite in there. And that's always helpful. Another place to go is the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. This is just an amazing free resource online, peer-reviewed. They give just surveys of literatures, and there are boatloads of SCP entries on philosophy of time, personal identity, presentism, eternalism, all these sorts of things. So the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy is another amazing place to go. I think those are good places to start, and then if you want to delve deeper into any particular issue, you'll be able to follow the references in both of those resources that I mentioned.
Okay. That sounds great. Well, thank you so much for being here. It's been a pleasure to, you know, have you on the first opening episode of the podcast. And it's been really great to kind of hear your explanations and your kind of thoughts, you know, arguments for different perspectives and so on. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's clear that the nature of time sits at the boundary between physics and philosophy, which I suppose is the reason I chose to kick off the show with them. On one hand, relativity shows that time depends on motion and gravity, with no universal now. On the other, quantum mechanics and theories of emergence suggest that time may not exist as a fundamental element at all, but it's something that arises from correlations, entropy, or the limits of our observation. The philosophical implications run deep. Eternalism presents a static universe where past, present, and future all coexist within a four-dimensional structure. Presentism, on the other hand, as we discussed, insists that only the current moment is real. Both have consequences for how we think about existence, identity, and choice. If all events are equally real, then free will becomes a question of causation rather than sequence. If only the present exists, then time itself becomes the defining feature of reality. Across every lens, scientific, metaphysical, and experiential, what we call time seems to shift. maybe it isn't an external river carrying us forward, but a pattern that we impose to make sense of change. We experience it because entropy increases, because our minds track that increase, and because memory and anticipation create a narrative of before and after. I suppose the question then isn't just whether time exists, but what kind of thing it is. Is it a dimension woven into the universe, or a construct emerging from it? The evidence points both ways, which might just be the most honest answer that science and philosophy can offer for now. Thanks for listening to Inertia. I'm Rania Sutton. Join me next time as we continue exploring how the most familiar aspects of our lives, like time, motion, and consciousness, reveal how little we truly understand the world around us.